economics, you were dismissed as naive. It was, of course, about security, about liberating Iraqis from Saddam.
Journalist Naomi Klein will be back with her speech in a minute. Authority Stealing by Fela here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Is returned to journalist Naomi Klein.
Meanwhile, at home, the administration quickly moved to exploit the shock that gripped the nation to push through a radical vision of hollow government in which everything from waging wars to reconstructing from those wars to disaster response became an entirely for-profit venture. This was a bold evolution of market logic. Rather than the 90s approach of selling off existing public companies like water and electricity, the Bush team was creating a whole new framework for its actions. That framework was and is the war on terror, which was built to be private, privately managed from the start. The Bush administration played the role of a kind of a venture capitalist for the startup security companies. And they created an economic boom on par with the dot-com boom of the 1990s. But we didn't talk about it because we were too busy talking about security. Now, this feat required a kind of two-stage process, which was using 9/11, of course, to radically increase the surveillance and security powers of the state, concentrated in the executive branch, but at the same time, to take those powers and outsource them to a web of private companies, whether Blackwater, Boeing, AT&T, Halliburton, Bechtel, the Carlyle Group. Now, in the 80s, the goal of privatization and in the 90s was devouring the appendages of the state. But what was happening now is it was the core that was being devoured, because what is more central to the very definition of a state, of a government, than security and disaster response? Now, this is one of the great ironies of the war on terror, is that it proved such an effective weapon to furthering the corporate agenda precisely because it denied that it has, and continues to deny that it has a corporate agenda at all. Now, it had another benefit too, which was the ability to paint anyone who opposed this system as aligned with potential terrorists and so on. So our movement, which was already facing extreme repression before 9/11, was put on notice as traitorous. Looking back, it's clear that the shock, the disorientation caused by the attacks, was used to reassert this economic agenda, to reassert that consensus that never really was. The window that was opened at the end of the 90s in the movement known as the anti-globalization movement, but which was always a pro-democracy movement, was slammed shut, at least in North America. And it was terror that slammed it shut. The alternative started to disappear. Now, I want to use the rest of my time just to say that this was not the first time. That this, if we look back at the past 35 years, we see this slamming of the door on alternatives just as they are emerging, repeating again and again. Many of you were here for the opening address from Ricardo Lagos, the former president of Chile, who talked about another September 11th, which was another one of those moments, a far more significant one, when a very important democratic alternative, the real third way, not Tony Blair's third way, but the real third way between totalitarian communism and extreme capitalism was being forged in Chile. And that was the great threat. And we know that now through all the declassified documents. There's a really revealing one, a correspondence between Henry Kissinger and Nixon, in which Kissinger says very bluntly that the problem with Allende's election is is not what they were saying publicly, which was that he was aligned with the Soviets, that he was only pretending to be democratic, but that he was really going to impose a totalitarian system in Chile. That was the spin at the time. What he actually wrote was, the example of a successful elected Marxist government in Chile would surely have an impact on and even precedent value for other parts of the world. The imitative spread of similar phenomena elsewhere would in turn significantly affect the world balance and our own position in it. So that alternative, that other world, had to be blasted out of the way, and extreme violence was used in order to accomplish that. Now, this kind of preemptive attack on our democratic alternatives, the persistent dream of a third way, of a real third way, has come up again and again. And this is what I discuss at length in the book. But I want to mention a couple of examples, unless I'm totally out of time. Okay. Examples of moments where there was a similar sense of effervescent possibility, of being able to breathe more and dream more fully. One of them was in Poland in 1989. June 4th was the day of the historic elections in Poland that elected Solidarity as the new government. They hadn't had elections there in decades. And this was the event that really set off the domino, what's now referred to as the domino effect in Eastern Bloc countries, and ultimately resulting in the breaking apart of the Soviet Union. But it's worth remembering what it actually looked like in June of 1989. In Poland, people didn't think that history was over because they had just elected Solidarity as their government. They thought that history was just beginning, and that they were finally going to be able to implement what the movement, which was a labor movement, had always seen as the third way. The third way not taken. Now, Solidarity's vision was not a rejection of socialism. They said that they were calling for real socialism, as socialists often do. And it was a rejection of the Communist Party. They were everything that the party was not, dispersed where it was centralized, democratic where it was authoritarian, participatory where it was bureaucratic. And Solidarity had 10 million members, which gave them the power to completely shut down the state. So when people went to the polls and elected a Solidarity government, what were they voting for? What did they think they were voting for? Did they think that they were voting to become a free market economy on the model that Francis Fukuyama was talking about? No, they didn't. They thought they were voting for the Labour Party that they had helped to build. And I just want to read you a short passage from Solidarity's economic program, which was passed democratically in 1981. They said, the socialized enterprise should be the basic organizational unit in the economy. It should be controlled by the workers' councils representing the collective and should be operated cooperatively run by a director appointed through competition recalled by the council, workers' cooperatives. So the idea was to get the party out of control of the economy, to decentralize it and have the people who were doing the work actually control their workplaces. And they believed that they could make them more sustainable. Now, did they get the chance to try that, to act on that vision of workers, a worker cooperative economy as the centerpiece of the economy, to have democratic elections, but still have socialism? Did they get that chance when they voted for Solidarity? No, they didn't. What they got was an inherited